National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Is there a genocide of Christians in Nigeria? The terrible attacks in the African country have raised the alarm of international religious liberty advocates. This week on Register Radio, we talk to Eric Patterson, Vice President of the Religious Freedom Institute, about the violence. And then, Register Senior Editor Joan Frawley Desmond tells us the incredible story of a Carmelite nun who was a late vocation. The late Anne Miller was a mother of 10 adult children before she entered Carmel. Her daughter, Janet Miller Abbott, shares her insights. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. You know, a chilling testimony was heard on Capitol Hill this month during a U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom panel about the terrible violence that's being perpetrated against Christians in Nigeria. It's a terrible situation that's receiving very little attention from Western media, and that's why the Register's been focusing on this. Since 2015, more than 2,000 churches have been destroyed, and the country has witnessed a mass exodus of 4 to 5 million Christians who fled the war-torn country of Nigeria. Register digital editor Elisa Murphy has followed this story for the Register, and she brings us insights from an international religious freedom advocate now.
We have Eric Patterson with us, Vice President at Religious Freedom Institute. He does extensive work keeping his finger on the pulse of threats to religious freedom domestically here in the U.S., as well as globally. And Eric, we're so glad you could join us today. Given these tragic stories coming out of Nigeria, we're hearing about mass killings, kidnappings of Christians and other minorities. Testimony was heard on Capitol Hill this month about, and I quote, somberly, babies being ripped from the womb by Islamic terrorists. Now, the woman offering testimony was in the northeastern region of Nigeria. And I do understand that there are two factions at play here, Boko Haram more to the north, and as you pointed out, the dire situation in Nigeria's middle belt, where you said last year that Christians there faced expulsion if no one came to their aid. What does the situation on the ground look like there today?
Well, Alyssa, thank you very much for having me here and for bearing witness to the attacks on people of actually almost every faith group in Nigeria, but in particular, this slaughter of Christians, both in the north and in the middle belt of the country. And you're exactly right that there is the terrorist group Boko Haram and an overlapping distinct terrorist group that's a Islamic State group that's in that part of the country in the north and northeast. But they've perpetrated attacks throughout the country, both on fellow Muslims, Sunni Muslims, and on Shia Muslims, and then against Christians, literally trying to exterminate the Christians from that area. In the middle belt, as you were just suggesting, this is a part of the country where the demographics are more evenly divided between Muslims and Christians. Historically, these groups are from different tribal groups, and historically, a part of what is going on is that there are differences between those who are cattle herders and whatnot against farmers and village folk. But what we've seen is that this is not just about land or water. This has been the torching of churches, the beheading of Christians, the seeking out of Christians and violating their bodies in the way that you just described in a very systematic way. And it's been going on for years now.
You know, it's just such a tragedy. I know from a recent report, more than 12,000 Christians in Nigeria have been killed in attacks since June of 2015, I believe. Some consider Boko Haram to be synonymous with ISIS, but they have a very different origin. Can you tell us about this terrorist group?
Yes, you're exactly right. Boko Haram really started more as a localized movement rather than a well-thought-out campaign. Its name means essentially no to Western education. So it began as a revisionist group that wanted to take society in the northern part of Nigeria, where they had instituted Sharia law alongside civil law more than a decade ago. And they wanted to take it back to, say, the 12th century of Islam and reject essentially all things Western, or as much Western, the values of the West, democracy, the equality of men and women, Christian influences, that entire package being rejected for a 12th century kind of feudal form of Islam. And they've been doing that. They've coalesced into a much better organization, and they've been doing it through terror, intimidation, kidnappings, rape, slavery, and murder.
Now, focusing strictly on Christian persecution, amid this widespread terrorism. As we were just discussing, Nigeria's middle belt seems to be where we are seeing most of the deaths. The bloodshed seems to be at the hands of the Fulani, and I'm not sure if I'm correct on that, but can you tell us about the Fulani, who they are, and how long they've had this stronghold? I believe the middle belt is where we are seeing so many reports of priests and seminarians being kidnapped, just remembering Michael Nnadi killed just earlier this year in Nigeria's Kaduna state.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we often hear the term Hausa Fulani, which are two distinct but intermarried Muslim predominant tribes that are among the biggest in all of Nigeria. Interestingly, over the past decade, a lot of people haven't realized that although these two have often worked together or intermarried, that there's actually been Fulani on Hausa violence as well. But the Fulanis are they're a large national group, tens of millions of people in the region. Sometimes in the West, we say the word tribe, and we mean, you know, a very, very small group of people. But this is a national group that's tens of millions strong. The current president of Nigeria, I believe, is Fulani. So they have power. They have representation. This is not a small indigenous group that's somehow hidden away in a corner of the country being mistreated. And what we've seen is historically rivalries between tribal groups, including ones that are Christians, but specifically in the Middle Belt, we have seen the radicalization of this. Instead of it simply being about land or water or growing populations that are butting heads, the spray painting of Allahu Akbar on churches, the burning of churches, the targeting of seminarians, the recent decapitation of priests, the attacks on missionaries, nuns, evangelists, pastors, that is religious violence directed specifically at Christians. And just this year, reports are that at least 1,300 Christians have been killed in that region in Nigeria this year alone.
Just considering this wave of terrorism we are seeing from then these two factions taking hold in Nigeria, many consider religious freedom to be kind of the precursor here, leading then to religious disagreement. But you have a very unique, different idea. You say it's actually religious repression that leads to this type of aggression. Can you expound on that?
Yes. What typically happens is not that an opening towards democracy, human rights, respect for one's neighbors, religious tolerance, that package of liberties, we don't really have places in the world where as a country becomes more like that, people start killing each other more. It's typically the opposite. It is typically that when you have the breakdown of institutions, when you have politicians who will emphasize not what binds the country together, but my tribe over that tribe, I'm going to deliver for my people, not those people. When leaders scapegoat the other, I'm gonna be a leader for my group of people, and it's those other ones who are a problem in our country. All of those are the types of things that heighten cleavages that may already exist because of different tribal origins or things. And in Nigeria, that's the type of thing we're happening. And when adults, when leaders, when religious leaders, such as clerics who support Boko Haram or give justification to these Fulani tribesmen, in any of these cases, often what they're doing is they're radicalizing the parts of the religion that justify, oh, they're an infidel, you can take them out. Oh, they're a Western influence preaching Christianity, you can take them out. Oh, they're women can be slaves or sex slaves because they're second class citizens. And so it's being used as a cycle of violent language and rhetoric. And when you train up a bunch of teenage boys on that, they become very, very violent.
You mentioned inaction. I know last year Nigeria was listed by then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo as a country of, quote, particular concern, which brought the country under the same radar as some of the biggest religious freedom violators like Iran and China. Given the nonstop uptick of violence we seem to be seeing in Nigeria, is anything more being done? And is the current administration taking the situation seriously?
It's heartening that finally the U.S. Department of State took this step in December of 2020 to list Nigeria as a country of particular concern alongside, as you said, Iran and North Korea and others. Nigeria is very, very important. Maybe we can talk about that in a moment. But what is being done, I have to say that it's pretty disappointing that the current ambassador there has dismissed that there's any religious elements to this. and has said in a recent interview that these are just old grievances based on land and water rights. And, you know, if you don't get the right diagnosis of a problem, then you can't solve the problem. And not taking into account the way that there's been a radicalization of the violence along jihadist lines misses the types of things that are lurking in the background and what have made the conditions in Nigeria increasingly violent. If there was not a religious dimension, then we wouldn't have Boko Haram. If there wasn't a religious dimension, we wouldn't have Islamic State in that area. And of course, we wouldn't have the targeting of churches and Christians. So much more needs to be done.
Just earlier this year, the president of the Nigerian Bishops Conference said the attacks against Christians are really due to a lack of security. Do you see a unified effort to really call out Nigeria?
I really don't see it that way. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. One is it sometimes feels like it's just impossible to get our hands around this. A second is the U.S. just has never really devoted enough time, attention, and resources to Africa. Another is it seems like this administration is dragging its feet on these types of very, very real issues really around the globe. It's been reluctant to call out religious freedom violators and ethno-religious violence in Burma, China, and elsewhere. In other words, the religious dimensions, attacking people because their ethno-religious heritage or affiliation is a certain thing, like the Uyghurs, like the Rohingya, etc. The lack of an appointment of a U.S. ambassador for religious freedom. Those things suggest that at least in this early in the Biden administration, it is moving no faster than previous administrations. In fact, perhaps slower on taking into account the deep religious cleavages that are causing violence in Nigeria.
Just was thinking of that too, of the fact that, you know, there's no new Sam Brownback in office. And I know he did extensive work on the field of religious freedom, given the aggression we're seeing not only in Nigeria, as we're discussing, but also in China. Eric, can I just ask, you know, we only have limited time, unfortunately, given your work and your understanding of these tragedies, not only in Nigeria, but also around the world, why as Catholics, as Christians, should we all fall to our knees and pray for the persecuted in Nigeria? Why is prayer still our best defense?
It's asking him for guidance about what we're supposed to be doing, as well as asking the Lord to be involved in spiritual agency to defeat powers of darkness. And so praying for the Nigerian government, a prayer of goodwill that its leaders will have the capacity and the ability to stand up against these things, to pray that regional leaders in West Africa and international leaders will have creative solutions and the will to intervene in positive ways, such as developing professional security forces in Nigeria that will help. We need to be praying about what we can do as believers to ameliorate suffering, whether that's through giving or things there on the ground. And of course, we can be praying as Christians, first for goodwill, that all people will live in peace and security, even if they're not Christians.
Amen. Well, Eric, I really can't thank you enough for your time. And we hope to have you back to learn more about Eric Patterson and the Religious Freedom Institute. You can visit religiousfreedominstitute.org. Thank you so much for your time today, Eric. We really appreciate it.
A transcript of Elisa Murphy's conversation with Eric Patterson can be found at ncregister.com. It's called Rape, Slavery, Murder in Nigeria. When we come back, we are joined by Register Senior Editor Joan Frawley Desmond with the story of Ann Miller, a mother of 10 who became a Carmelite nun. This is Register Radio. More when we return.
In these uncertain times, Catholics depend on EWTN's National Catholic Register. The Register is so much more than a newspaper. It's your faith, your life, your source of information and spiritual resources. The Register is uplifting, redemptive journalism, interviews with Catholic leaders and newsmakers, liturgical coverage, health, financial, and political topics, and analysis of the key issues you care most about. EWTN's National Catholic Register covers every aspect of the Catholic faith that impacts your world. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. That's ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and we have a unique vocation story to share with you today. A Carmelite sister, Mary Joseph of the Trinity, died a few weeks ago at the age of 92 in a Carmelite monastery in Illinois. Her story was a most unusual one. This Carmelite, who was buried in the traditional brown habit and black veil after living 31 years behind the grail, had been a wife, a mother of 10, a grandmother of 28, a great-grandmother of 16. Wow. Her name before Carmel was Ann Miller. Register Senior Editor Joan Frawley Desmond blogged at ncregister.com about this remarkable vocation story of a mother, a wife, a Carmelite, all in one. Both Joan and Janet Miller Abbott, one of Anne's daughters, joins us now. Welcome, Janet. Thank you for sharing your mother's story with us here.
Well, thank you, Jeanette, and thanks for having me.
You know, before we hear about your own experience of your mother's vocation, including what was for many a controversial decision to join Carmel, I'd like to share with our listeners and you how we came to publish Joan's blog. So we have these daily editors' meetings, and during one of those meetings, one of our editors saw a tweet from your brother Mark Miller, and he had tweeted, "A 92-year-old nun died today in a Carmelite monastery in Illinois. She was an unusual kind of nun. She didn't sing very well. She was frequently late to her required duties around the convent. She threw sticks for the communal dog, which was not allowed, and she was my mother." And we just thought, wow, that's a really great idea. And then Joan pipes up and says, wait a minute, I knew her. Joan, what did you remember of Ann Miller that was worth telling?
Well, just for starters, Ann was one of my mother's closest friends, and I also went to high school with Ann, with Ann's daughters, Marion Miller, Janet, Leslie, and others. So I knew the family very well. We went on retreats together. We went on trips abroad together to the Holy Land, to Rome, to Austria. So we had a lot of chance to get to know each other. Ann was also a very prominent social and civic figure in San Francisco. She did some amazing work. People are still celebrating her now, well after her departure, in many unique ways, both in the church and also in other areas of science and philanthropy. She entered the Carmel in 1989, 5 years after the death of her husband, Dick. And they had talked about possibly being, as I recall, Third Order Franciscans. They had talked about other possibilities. But instead, you know, he passed away. And then she decided she was going into the Carmel. And she marked her departure with a farewell party for 800 people. She apparently, I wasn't there. My sister was. I was out of country. So it was such a huge throng. Anne tied balloons on her so people could find her in the crowd. And, you know, people came there with a variety of emotions. Some people were excited for her. Some people had questions. Some thought she should have stayed, you know, home and not gone into the monastery, given that she had 10 children. And my favorite line is from her granddaughter, Jane, who told the Chicago Tribune that the transformation of Anne into, you know, Sister Mary Joseph of the Trinity was like the Great Gatsby turned into the Sound of Music.
Right.
So that sort of sums it all up, I'd say.
Yeah, right. Well, Janet, I mean, you obviously had an even much more personal experience of your mother's vocations. What was your own reaction, and why did you wish to share these memories with Joan for so many people to read? Tell us about that. You know, why you said yes to our blog.
You know, every aspect and perception, you know, was different from all people. And I just felt that some of the articles that had been written before, or, you know, my brother's tweet, which was all very interesting and whatnot, it really kind of missed the point spiritually.
Hmm.
And a lot of people just didn't understand the spiritual level of that my mother had and her spirituality. And I just celebrated with the fact that she could have the opportunity to become a Carmelite and to take on this new life in Carmel. And I just wanted to, you know, kind of add a different dimension to what everybody was publishing before that.
So what did you find, Janet, the most moving part of your mother's transition from one life to another?
You know, basically inside, you know, she's her personality and everything stayed the same. I mean, she was still just the funniest sense of humor and, you know, great vitality, etc. You could just see this calmness coming over as she kind of shed, you know, the outside world, as we would say. I remember one time I brought my then 4-year-old son, who was born after she left, and he was standing on a table outside the grill and holding on to the we called the bars. And my mother said to him, "You know, Robert, what are you thinking?" And he said to her, "Well, Grandma, I'm just wondering why you're in this jail."
Right.
And she looked at him and she said, "Robert, we're not behind the bars. You are." And to me, that said a lot of her decision and her transformation into really grasping and becoming part of Carmel.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful story. I have a 4-year-old, so that makes a total sense. But I love the fact that you know what you see and want to tell is her spiritual journey, because that's what this sounds like it was. I mean, what was it like? Joan has written about this in her blog, but what was it like growing up with your mother who, you know, who worked a Tiffany pin that said "Try God" on her fashionable clothes, you know, and then really made the decision to enter into that "Try God"? What was that like?
Well, actually, I mean, first of all, it was always an adventure. There was never anything dull going on. And whatever group my mother joined or was leading or whatnot, we all helped. I mean, from Barry Goldwater's campaign, you know, to when she founded ARCS in Northern California, we were all there, you know, helping getting it organized. I mean, she really had an army of helpers. And so we learned quite early on how to, you know, be part of a community, be involved, give back. And then the religious side was just as important. I mean, I can't even think of a car ride where we didn't, within 5 minutes of pulling out of the driveway, have to whip out our rosaries and, you know, say the daily rosary from wherever we were going. And we just had a lot of spirituality in our upbringing, which, as individuals, you can embrace. God gives us free will, or you can say, "Well, this isn't for me," or kind of fight back. So that's what it is. In a family of 10, you have all the different personalities, and I happen to be one of the group that embraced that part of her life. That I just loved it.
So, of course, there are other examples of mothers who entered religious life after their husband died. Why do you think your mother's story has sparked such a powerful reaction? I mean, it's made news. I've seen countless stories, you know, on this, NPR, The Washington Post. I mean, just countless stories, and they're out in California as well. Why is her story so attractive?
Well, I think, you know, in the late 20th and now the 21st century, you don't find, especially in the United States, you know, people celebrating, you know, vocations. And most of the U.S., you know, they're putting spirituality on the back burner. And, you know, Pope St. John Paul II, he always discussed relativism and humanism in lives. And we're constantly bombarded in society, in the media, movies, whatever, that your individual happiness comes first. And so I think this story causes people to take a new look at their own lives. You know, God put us here to serve, and we can find happiness in, you know, serving others, which my mother did her first 61 years of life, and then her next 31 years, she served God in, you know, prayer for the benefit of all of us.
I feel like knowing the family as I do and appreciating all sides of the equation, and then also as a mother who has three children who also have their own points of view about the faith and where they are on the faith journey, I think one of the things that was so interesting and moving for me, as Janet said, about her mother giving this sense, embracing this sense of peace over time in the Carmel, is that all of us in the world, you know, who care about the faith, want to bring the joys of the faith, the gift of the faith to our children. And then if it doesn't happen in the time frame we hope it will, we worry about it. We may intervene, mm-hmm. we may argue, we may just be stressed out. And a lot of us, of course, try to pray. And at some point, Ann Miller, as Sister Mary Joseph of the Trinity, devoted that or channeled that anxiety and concern for her children into prayer completely. And that to me was very moving, because I know it was a big piece of the larger puzzle. And even with everyone having their own point of view, that's where a lot of mothers who are Catholic are coming from, don't you think?
Definitely. That was part of my mother's goal in joining Carmel.
Well, I am so appreciative of both of you sharing your insights into the story of Ann Miller. You can read Joan's story at ncregister.com. Search I Got It. Daughter offers perspective on her mother's decision to become a cloistered Carmelite nun. This is Register Radio. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, to check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on EWTN Radio. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.